This is a Radio Frimley Park podcast.
Welcome to Inside the Hospital, the series that focuses on the people behind many of the non-clinical roles in hospital. In this episode, we'll be focusing on volunteering and meeting some of the people who give up their own time to help across Frimley Health Trust hospitals as a volunteer. Start at the top. Looking after hundreds of volunteers across the Trust is Mike Stone, the volunteering manager. I've come to Frimley Park Hospital to meet him in the studios of Radio Frimley Park, another voluntary organisation, to find out why a hospital needs volunteers and what it's like to coordinate them.
Hi, I'm Mike Stone. I'm the Voluntary Services Manager for Frimley Health NHS Foundation Trust, by which I manage volunteers right the way across the Trust. So wherever we've got volunteers in a hospital, then we manage them. Myself and the team that work with me manage those volunteers. In this role, probably about 8 years, I've been with the Trust 10 years. So originally I was based at Wexham, and then when the merger happened, I now work across Trust. So yeah, 10 years in the Trust.
What drew you to working in this role?
I think, like with a lot of people, it's just things that happen, isn't it? I worked for Northampton General Hospital as their fundraising volunteers manager, and then, like a lot of people, decided to come out of the NHS, and I was at the NHS for just under 2 years working for a charity, and I decided that I've actually really missed the NHS, and this job came up with, as it was, Wexham Park Hospital. Then I applied for it and lucky enough to get it, and very, very pleased. So I've been in the NHS now for probably about 20 years with a short break in the middle. But yeah, love it, absolutely love it.
How did you wind up in a career in the NHS? Is that something you set out to do from when you were young, or has it just evolved over time that you sort of naturally fell into it?
I think I naturally fell into it. I was working for an organisation called the Patients Association, for which I was chief executive, and Claire Rayner was the chairman. And it was a lovely job. Unfortunately, Claire died and the organisation changed dramatically, and I decided that without her there, it wasn't particularly an organisation I wanted to work for then. So that's when I applied to join the NHS at Northampton General Hospital, and yeah, I got the job there. It's a sort of series of circumstances that I knew. I was living up there at the time and it was a local job, but for this job specifically, in terms of the voluntary services manager, kind of fundraising at the beginning and volunteers, but then just volunteers. And it's, I've been lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time, I think.
Can you describe a sort of a memorable moment for you? What sticks out as sort of a highlight that's happened recently for you in this job?
Every day is a highlight. I know that's a cliche, but the general things about seeing so many volunteers enjoying what they do is absolutely brilliant. I think there's got to be a couple of highlights. The first one was only 2 weeks ago when my manager came to me. He said, we need to do something about improving staff morale, which we did. We brought in 3 penguins to Wexham Park Hospital, which is soon going to be repeated here at Frimley Park Hospital. The effect that those 3 penguins had on staff morale was absolutely incredible. We had about 350 staff come through in about 2 hours seeing these 3 little penguins, which one of your colleagues, Malcolm Tree, nicknamed the 3 Amigos. And they just wandered around in a garden in Wexham, and they absolutely fantastic. That really was a highlight. Another highlight was a couple of years ago, we always do a volunteers afternoon tea, and realising that one of my colleagues had got stuck in the lift with 4 volunteers at the venue. So I suddenly was faced with losing 4 volunteers and a very trusted colleague. So we had to wait until they were actually rescued by staff at the venue. But it was a highlight just in terms of having a conversation with these 4 volunteers and the volunteers, staff members stuck in the lift, assuring them everything was going to be all right. It was in the end.
So obviously you've told us what you do, but is there a perception people have about what your job is outside of this? So if you were to say, oh, I'm volunteer services manager, what would they think you do?
I think that they, you know, if you say to most people, oh, I'm voluntary services manager, they kind of know what you do. Some are quite surprised that the NHS actually has volunteers. Others are quite surprised that I'm actually paid to do a job that people say they would absolutely love to do, which is a lovely job. It is a good job. But you're dealing with different people all the time, different personalities. And we have to be honest that people volunteer for lots of different reasons, which is great. And we love having the volunteers. It's, in terms of the job itself, it's a management job. It's looking after people's welfare, making sure that they're happy in terms of the volunteer roles that they're taking on. We do get volunteers who start and they're not happy in the role that they've perhaps come into. And we talk to them and we try and change them to another role. So it is about people's happiness, which is always a good job.
So you touched on the fact that people are surprised. Why does the NHS have volunteers? So why does the NHS need volunteers?
If you look at the hospital, any hospital, look at Frimley Park in particular, we know that the staff are very, very busy. We know that clinical staff are rushed off their feet. And so it's about those volunteers doing roles that's working face-to-face, often with patients. One of our most popular roles is a patient companion who would actually sit there and talk to patients, sit there and read the paper with the patient, sit there and have a chat with the patient. We have to realise that a lot of patients don't have visitors. They're in here for a while. Perhaps they're not from around here. Perhaps their family live a long way away, so they don't get visitors. So our patient companions go in and they actually talk to people. And having a chat with them, which is really, really important. Age recovery, we know that. For example, as well, our hydration volunteers, which sounds nothing. It's a trolley that goes around the hospital with drinks on it. But they're different drinks. They're orange squashes, they're lemon squashes, they're blackcurrants, which isn't what we as a hospital serve out. So to give the patients something a little bit extra. I think the person who really hit it on the head was a manager of mine who said, volunteering's about improving the patient experience, and that's what it's got to be about. It's about making every person stay as good as it can be. And if we can do that by them linking up with volunteers and by the volunteers doing what they do to improve that patient experience, then hopefully we're on to a winner.
Obviously, and correct me if I'm wrong, there are hundreds of volunteers.
There are.
How do you coordinate all of those?
It's an operation that we've honed over a period of years. So we know what volunteers are active across the trust. We know what volunteers are active in each hospital. We know what volunteers are active in each department. And we know what volunteers are active on each ward and unit. So we've got a very big database that tells us who's where at any occasion. So you could turn around to me and say, Mike, where's this gentleman at the moment? So we could tell you from him signing in this morning or doing his QR code where he is and that he's in today and what he'll be doing. So it is a feat of organisation, and it does work. We can tell you, you know, that Frank the buggy driver will be in every Friday morning between 8 and 11 o'clock.
How many are there in your team, the paid team, coordinating it all?
So we have, she won't thank me for saying this, but we have 3.5 staff. We've got my deputy, Dervla. We've got Roz, who's the half, who works at Wrexham 3 days a week. And we've got Nicola, who works here at Frimley and also covers Heatherwood 5 days a week. So 4 of us, we're managing almost 800 people.
That's quite a feat.
It is, yeah.
How does someone become a hospital volunteer?
We've never had to advertise ever for volunteers. People just come to us. They come to their local hospital to volunteer because, well, for a number of reasons. Either maybe they've been a patient here. Maybe they've had a relative here and they want to come and volunteer here to say thank you. Maybe they've seen the NHS on the news. We had a huge amount of a huge increase in the number of volunteer applications just after COVID because everybody wanted to come and work or volunteer within the NHS. We never, as I said, we never have to advertise. People just come to us. They attend what's called a volunteer information session, which are held at Frimley and held at Wrexham once a month. And that tells them all about volunteering. From then, they decide whether they want to apply and if so, what they'd like to do.
Is there a minimum amount of time that someone can volunteer for?
Yeah, we try to be very strict in terms of when we take people on, we ask them to do 3 hours a week as a volunteer for a minimum of a year. That's because it costs us about £350 to recruit each volunteer in terms of the DBS that they go through, all the checks they go through, the admin time, and also their lovely polo shirt they get, and also the time of actually bringing them on board. That's why it's about £350. So we feel we're quite justified to ask for 3 hours a week for a minimum of a year. And also it makes people think, oh, can I really commit to that? Rather than just turning up. You'd be surprised the amount of phone calls we get saying, oh, I'd like to come along and volunteer tomorrow. It's not quite as simple as that.
Mm. Well, it's good to hear that you're choosing to vet these people, because obviously they're interacting potentially with vulnerable patients.
Absolutely.
What do you do to make sure that there is that safety with patients?
So every volunteer that we have has a DBS. Every volunteer also provides two references. And every volunteer also undergoes occupational health questionnaire. And if that flags up anything, then they'll be asked to go and see occupational health. So we believe we've got that covered up. The important thing as well is that we do an induction, very short induction for volunteers, but it covers things like safeguarding, information governance, equality and diversity. So stuff that we believe volunteers really need to know. As you say, volunteers have a responsibility. They're dealing with very vulnerable people. And never again can we have a volunteer like Jimmy Savile, because at the end of the day, he was a volunteer.
I guess one that might be difficult for you to answer, but maybe you've got knowledge from others who volunteer. What do you think is the benefit of volunteering for the Trust?
We do a survey of volunteers and why they volunteer and what they feel are the benefits. A lot of it's to do with getting out of their own house, for example. You know, we've got a lot of middle-aged to elderly volunteers. They want to get out and do something. They still want to be useful. They still want to not work, but do something, activity outside just being retired, for example. So it is about volunteers meeting people, talking to people, having company. Very, very important for a lot of our people. And also that feeling of doing something with the NHS. A lot of our volunteers tell us that it's about coming into this environment and doing something for the local hospital.
So if someone's listening to this now and they're in the local area and they want to volunteer with Frimley Health Trust, how can they do that? What's the first step to take?
So the first step to take is, let's make it easy, first of all. Get them to email me, just mike.stone@nhs.net, saying they'd like to volunteer, and I'll supply all the details about how they can go through that volunteering process to see whether they really want to volunteer.
It's not just direct hospital volunteers that Mike helps with. He's assisting many third-party organisations that operate with volunteers within the Trust, including our very own Radio Frimley Park.
Yeah, I think, you know, in terms of being here, we've always worked very closely with Radio Frimley Park. And we do recruit the volunteers who come to your radio station. And, you know, it's about us as an organisation working with other groups of people who also volunteer. And it's very, very important. So we've got a number of organisations who volunteer within the hospital, but it's still very important for us to have that responsibility to make sure that all volunteers go through the correct process before they actually start volunteering.
Do you work with the RVS shop as well?
Yeah, we do work with the RVS shop and also a number of other organisations who come in and do their volunteers come in and do stuff within the hospital.
Mike loves what he does, and it's clear he's committed and passionate about ensuring volunteers get as much out of volunteering as the Trust does from their help. I'm keen to meet some of the people who regularly volunteer and understand some of the different roles that they perform. First up, I'm meeting Jenny, who has what I think must be one of the most challenging roles to perform, an end-of-life companion.
Hi, my name's Jenny Schofield, and I'm an end-of-life companion at Frimley Health.
So how long have you been working in this role?
10 years in this role, because I came from another role which I run alongside.
What is the other role?
I work with the chaplain's team, and I have done for 18 years, and working with the chaplain's team led me into the end-of-life team.
And how long overall have you been at Frimley Park Hospital?
18 years in all.
What drew you to the role? How did you end up working or volunteering
working here?
Here.
18 years ago this year, my husband died very unexpectedly. He didn't die at home. He was brought here to Frimley Park. and the staff were amazing. I have to say, they were really, really good. They kept me informed. They were extremely good with my husband. And after he died, I picked myself up and thought, I'd like to give something back. And I already was a person of faith, very involved with my church. And I thought that perhaps working with the chaplain's team was the way to go. And at the time, I hadn't been bereaved very long. So the chaplain who was here then said, well, I might take you on. Let's see how you are. And obviously, I passed muster. And that's when it all began.
Before that had happened to you, what were you doing?
I was working as a teaching assistant, and I had done for, it's funny, 18 years again, in a private school here in Frimley. And I loved that work. But we were retiring, my husband and I, 8 weeks actually after he died. So that came to an end because I wanted to retire then from that sort of work. And then I came to Frimley and I've been here ever since.
So you mentioned obviously that was 18 years. Does that mean you're considering that the 18 years are now up with this one and changing career?
No, not at all. I will go on as long as I possibly can. I'm quite an elderly lady now, so I will go until I just feel maybe physically I can't do the work anymore. No, I don't want to give it up at all. I love it.
So for people who perhaps you've not met before, how would you explain what you do to them?
I would say to them that I have a privileged job within Frimley Park, and I sit with people who are at their end of life, either last days, last hours, and I just come alongside them. I can support the family if they're there. And it's an amazing thing to do, to walk the last stages of a person's life with them is very special to me.
What would you describe as a sort of typical day? Obviously, you're a volunteer. Are you here every day? Or are you
here
occasionally?
No, I'm not. When I was doing chaplaincy work only, I was probably here for a couple of mornings a week or a couple of afternoons. But end of life, one shift a week I do, which is a four-hour shift, and I come in on a Tuesday from 8 o'clock in the morning until midday. And you have a list of people who are on the palliative care team's list being at end of life, and they actually do have to be in their last hours or days, what is known medically as actively dying. So we go and sit with them for as long or as little as need be. And if there are more than one person on the list, then it's very difficult to split yourselves, because if you go to someone and you really feel the need is there, it's extremely difficult to get up after perhaps an hour and go off to somebody else. But that's what you normally do. However, if I find that the person is receptive to me being there, then I will stay for however long it needs to be.
You touched there that the palliative care team are picking these people and providing a list. Is there
Yes.
a group of you who are working?
There is a group. I would think there's probably about 9 or 10 of us in the group, and we have a closed WhatsApp group, so that when somebody comes on duty, they say, I am here and I am with such and such a patient. We never give names on the group. It's only the ward number and the bed number or side room number. So no names are ever put on there for security reasons. And we go from patient to patient. And then we can say to the palliative care team, these people have either died or don't need a companion. So have you anyone else on the list? And that's the way it works. It works very well, actually. And as you leave your shift, you just put a little resume of what you've done that morning, and whoever is following will pick that up and then go to those patients.
So that facilitates you to be able to sort of hand over what
yes.
you've been doing before.
Yes, and you'll say, you know, the patient is restless, or the patient is well settled, or there are relatives there at the moment, but perhaps you could go back and give them a break. Sometimes relatives have been there all night or for hours, and they actually need a coffee or a walk or some fresh air. So you introduce yourself. You know, I'm one of the companions at the hospital, and this is our role. And if you'd like a break, then I'm very willing to sit with your relative, father, mother, whoever while you go for a break. And it's really good, and it's very appreciated by the families these days. More and more information is getting round the hospital as to the work we do. And relatives are really grateful. I was sitting with someone recently, and I'd been there since 8 o'clock in the morning, and somebody had said to me that they liked opera. Now, this patient wasn't communicating, but was awake. So I found some opera channels on my phone and played them quietly on her pillow. And the reaction was brilliant, because in a crescendo of music, her eyes were opening really wide. And I just knew that in her mind, she was following this aria, which was lovely. And eventually, I had to go and see someone else. And I thought, don't want to leave her, don't want to turn the phone off. And just as I was thinking this, her two daughters arrived. And I said, I'm just leaving, but I have been playing music. And they were overjoyed. They said, this is something really special for Mum. So you can make a difference to people, even if they're not receptive, really, to voice, or they're not actually communicating.
It sounds like it's a real opportunity to be there for somebody at that moment and to provide them something, just a connection for those last moments.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I've done that before. I was sitting a few months ago now with a gentleman, and I said to the nurse, we were in a side room, and she came in to do some obs, and I said, this gentleman's got beautiful fingers, beautiful hands. She said, oh, yes, he used to be a pianist. And that struck a chord, and he wasn't awake as such, although I do believe people even in comas do hear you. So I thought about this, and I found a Mozart piano concerto, again, on my mobile phone, and I played it, and there'd been no reaction from this gentleman, apparently, for a number of hours. And as I was watching him, because we keep a close eye on patients, tears started rolling down his face, which really got to me. And I thought, this is amazing. And very, very slowly, his fingers were twitching as if he was sort of going through the concerto. And the nurse came back in, and I sort of, I'd never done this before. And I said, oh, is that okay? I'm playing music. And she said, is there any reaction? And I said, look at his face. I've dried his tears twice. And she rushed off and found a radio and brought it in. And she said, we're going to play classical music for him. So it's a really strange thing to say, that you can bring an amazing amount of comfort to people in their last hours if you find a little bit about them and you can tap into that. It's just, to me, it's a privilege, and that's all I can really say. It's an amazing ministry.
You mentioned, obviously, trying to understand the patient that you're with. Mm. Is it often the case that they're non-communicative, or do you get some sort of indication from the nursing staff or the doctors as to, you know, a bit about them?
Yes, you do. I mean, I always, when I go on shift and I go on to the first ward or any ward, I go and introduce myself to the staff, and I say, I've come to see the patient so-and-so and so-and-so. Can I have a name? What do they like to be called by? Do they have any relatives or visitors that come? Do you know anything about them? What do they like? Try and get a proper handover, so that when you go, you can, suppose it's Dave, you can say, hello, Dave, you know, I'm Jenny, and I've come to sit with you to keep you company until your visitors arrive, or whatever. Just introduce yourself. And sometimes you have no reaction whatsoever. And another time you'll get a sort of flutter of the eyelids or a little twitch. And you just know that they've understood what you've said, but they obviously can't answer back. And I often just sit and hold a hand. And sometimes with the elderly ladies, you just feel compelled to perhaps stroke their head or just some physical contact, so that they know that there's another human being there beside them and they're not alone.
These are obviously very difficult moments, perhaps for you personally. How do you deal with that sort of the revisiting death on a regular basis?
That's a good question, because when I was young, I was terrified of death and dying. Absolutely terrified to the fact I had a nervous breakdown. And the basis of it was this fear of dying. When I was really quite young, sort of 19 onwards until my late 30s. And something changed within me then. I think my father-in-law died and I'd never seen a dead person. A mother-in-law wanted us to go and view the body. And I thought, I can't do this. And suddenly something, I do, as I say, have a faith. And something lifted me off the chair and said, go and see him. And he taught me more in death than he ever did when I knew him as being alive, because there was nothing to be frightened of, absolutely nothing to be scared of. And having sat now in later life with my mother and my father, I've been blessed, because many people don't sit with the people they love most at that moment of death. And I was with my mum, my dad, and my husband. And it's not a frightening situation, and it doesn't scare me anymore, and I can be there. And when I leave the hospital, I'm sad for the family, but it's not my grief. And if I am upset, there was only one death that really, really affected me, and that was a child. And we don't often go to the children's ward, but I was called up before the chaplain had arrived, and I went up, and it was a very, very young child, 18 months old, something like that, who was clutching my finger. And that was hard, because that little man hadn't had a life. Most of the people I sit with have had good lives when you listen to the family. And it's a process. It comes to the end of your time. They're elderly people, most of them. And it's not so scary. It's a phase of life and death. But if I am upset in any way, I can always go back to the chaplains and speak to them. So we do have someone to talk to.
If there are people listening here who perhaps are going through something similar, where they've got a loved one who potentially is coming close to the end of their life, mm-hmm. how would they know to be able to use the service to have a companion come visit? Is that something they can speak to the members of staff?
Yes, if their relative was in hospital here.
Yeah.
Yes, if they speak to the ward staff, say, can you bleep one of the companions, please? So they would probably get hold of either the chaplaincy or the palliative care team, and they would put a message on our WhatsApp group, because we all carry our phones with us, and it would come up, can you please go to ward so-and-so, bay or bed so-and-so, so that we can be called. And if there isn't anyone on duty at that particular time, then often there is a shout put out, can anybody come in, please, because there's a need. And often someone will say, oh yes, I'm not doing anything, I'll come in and cover that shift.
What would you say if someone's listening and they perhaps wanted to consider this as a volunteer role themselves, are the skills that really make a good end-of-life companion?
Well, you do have a training session and you are told the do's and don'ts. I think you've just got to have an empathy with people. You've got to enjoy being with people and not be frightened of seeing a person who has died. You are taught to look for the signs. I mean, you're not just thrown into the ward and said, sit with that one. You are given training and you are spoken to by various people in different roles so that you are aware. But don't worry about it. It's an amazing role and you are given training and you're not left alone. So you wouldn't be given a first shift. You would go out with people who've been doing it for a while and shadow them for maybe one or two or three shifts until you feel confident to know what to do and who you can call on. So you're not left in the dark.
Good to know. You spoke about, obviously, you're there to sort of talk to the patient and you've played music to patients. What other sort of examples can you give of some things you might do? Do you read books or the newspaper?
Yes, if that's what the patient wants. Quite often, they are not responsive to anything. And in that case, you might spend your whole shift holding a hand and talking quietly. I always talk, not all the time, but let them know, you know, I'm still here, you're not alone, you're doing very well. Or sometimes people will wrinkle their faces and you know that they're ill at ease, they're not comfortable, and they'll wriggle. And I often hold a hand and say, if you can hear me, because you're never really sure, squeeze my hand, or maybe if you can, or perhaps blink your eyes if you have a pain. And very often you will get a response. And in that instance, I will go and find a member of staff and say, so-and-so is really not very comfortable. I have asked if they're in pain, and they've indicated that they are. So perhaps you can take it from there. And then they'll either get palliative care to come down, the team to come down and have a look, or they will, if the person is already written up for pain relief medication, then they might look on the charts and see if it's time for more. So nobody is ever left uncomfortable. And it's not always possible to get them to respond to things. Sometimes you just have to sit and hold a hand to know that there is a human being beside them. And that's comforting.
I imagine that for them, I mean, obviously you can't get responses necessarily, but it is that human connection, having that human connection at such a time.
Yes. And you'll often find that although they're not communicating in any way, if you put your hand on theirs, they will clutch it. And sometimes I've got a bit stiff and tried to move my, no, you're not going to let go of me, you know. So, okay, you put up with it and you let them hang on. Because it's, I often think, there but for the grace of God go I, and please let there be someone there for me and when I'm in that situation. And it's, that's the basis of it, that you're doing something for a human being who is going through a natural process. But it can be frightening, it can be lonely. So if you can be there and just provide human support and empathy, then it's very special. That's all I can say, really. It is a privileged position to be in.
We touched on continuity, and obviously you're sharing sort of notes between
colleagues.
Thank you. Do you find that you are often able to go back to the same person again, or because of the nature of the sort of role, you won't likely see them again before your next shift?
Well, yes, because I only do one shift a week on this particular role. But sometimes people who are told their end of life may go on for 1 or 2 weeks. You just don't know how bodies work. And I have been back to the same patient who perhaps was a little more receptive the first time. But then you say, you know, it's Jenny and I'm back. And it is good. But there is continuity, because sometimes you have to leave a patient during the day to go to another one, because there might be 3 or 4 you go and have check on. And if one has relatives, then that's fine. You leave them, you go back to the one you were with. One person, he was an extremely elderly person, over 100 actually, and they all said, oh, he's end of life. This amazing gentleman went on for over 2 weeks and was coherent some of the time and not others. And he had been a bomber pilot, one of the downbusters in the war. And one day I was sitting with him and he suddenly said something in German. Now, I understood that because I know a little bit of German. And the nurse said, what's he saying? What's he saying? And I said, he'd like some water, please. And she said, how did you know that? I said, because I understood what he said. So she said, oh, thank you very much. And we went off and he couldn't drink properly, but you can sponge the lips with water and make them moist. And that was a breakthrough moment as well. So there are times when you do go back and you feel an empathy with that person because you've walked quite a way of the path with them. So yeah, it does happen. And sometimes they're very funny times as well. I mean, I was sitting with someone, I won't go into any names or wards, this week. And obviously the gentleman had some form of dementia, and I had the most amazing conversation with him about a book that he was supposed to have written. And I just went with the story and I answered the questions he was asking, and, oh yes, that's very good, and I'd love to read it when you've written it. And he was just, the story was so funny. I had to keep a straight face, really. But it was lovely to be able, and I just went with his flow. He was popping from one thing, and it really didn't make a lot of sense. But for 2 hours, I sat with this person talking about the things he was doing, and it was just brilliant, because it didn't make a lot of sense, but to him it did. And a colleague said to me afterwards, what do you do when they talk sort of nonsense in a way? And I said, but it isn't nonsense to them. And you go with the flow. If they say they're writing a book, they're writing a book. And if they're writing it on a very strange situation, then so be it. Just go with the flow. And you really do reap some amazing rewards sitting with people in these situations. So I love it. So all I can say is I absolutely love what I do.
Thank you very much for sharing it with us.
My pleasure.
Speaking with Jenny, it's shown me how important a role like this is. A chance to have someone with you in your final moments who can just be there. I'm thankful that her and her team are able to provide such a service, and happy that patients don't need to be alone. To find out more about volunteering for your local hospital or trust, you can just search for NHS Volunteering or go to volunteering.england.nhs.uk. There are so many volunteer roles that we can't fit them into a single episode. So join me next time when we'll be meeting more volunteers and find out what they do inside the hospital.